to go right now.
The mindset.
I'm ready to go right now.
It's time.
John Brown's Mindset starts now.
On the Big 550 KTRS.
John and Trish are both off for a couple of days. I'm Paul Harris, proud to be filling in behind the microphones here at the Big 550 KTRS, and very happy to welcome back to the studio a couple of guys who have been on with me many times through the years, both separately and as a team. Dave Barry and Ridley Pearson. Welcome back, guys.
Hey, Paul.
Thanks. Good to be on the Big 550. Why can't you have real chairs here?
I don't know. We're not that big yet.
Where is the normal size?
It's like trick chairs. Ladies and gentlemen in the listening audience, when you sit on the trick chairs here at the Big 550,
yes,
you start out like about 6 feet off the floor, and the next thing you know,
it's quicksand.
And you're down on the floor.
It's whatever the opposite of hydraulic lift
exactly.
is.
That's
hydraulic drain.
That's why I'm standing for most of the show here, because I do go from 6'4" to Mickey Carroll.
I am afraid to find out what the toilets are like here at the Big 550.
They're also 6 feet off the ground. But they sink to normal height.
All right. All right. We'll never be invited back on this show.
That's right.
Clearly. But anyway.
You're always welcome on the show, as long as you keep writing books and signing them for my daughter. The new book is called Peter and the Sword of Mercy. It is the fourth book in their trilogy, which, as I pointed out last year, is because four is the new three.
Exactly.
That's it.
And they will be signing the book tonight and doing kind of a little stage presentation at the St. Louis County Library headquarters branch in Frontenac on Lindbergh Boulevard. And it's always a great crowd there. It's at 7 o'clock, but I would tell you, get there at 6 if you want to catch one of the flying frogs. Is that what you had last time?
Did we have frogs?
We talked about levitating frogs.
That's
what we're
science for.
But the more relevant animal is the snake.
There's a snake that you're bringing tonight?
No, we hope not. What Ridley is referring to is in our third book in our trilogy,
mm-hmm.
Peter and the Secret of Rundune. We had a snake. We had a big snake in that book, and when we would go around talking about it, we would read the chapter that involved the snake. And we were in Miami, where I live. The bookstore, which is my local bookstore, thought for a fun surprise, while we're reading it, they would bring in a real snake. Miami mm-hmm. is, as you may know, the snake capital of the United States.
I did not know that.
Not really in the United States in a way, but it's there are many, many snakes. You can rent snakes in Miami. It's a great...
Rent a snake?
Rent
yes,
a snake.
I feel like
which is what happened at this
any event.
Event
that you need a snake, a wedding, a bar mitzvah.
Today you are a snake.
Miami is your town. But anyway, they didn't tell us this. So we're reading this chapter, and there's all these children, young people, on the, you know, gathered around us on the floor. And the room is packed. And we look up while we're reading, and a guy... I guess the
wrangler, Dave.
Snake wrangler, although I don't think he was a licensed snake wrangler.
Definitely not.
Comes in with a 90-pound, 11-foot-long Burmese python.
11-foot-long.
11-foot, and maybe 9 inches in girth.
Wow.
Diameter.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was huge. I mean, huge. And he puts it on us. I mean, the snake kind of just makes itself comfortable wrapping itself around, wraps itself all the way around Ridley's neck.
Yeah.
I got him like a scarf.
Wow.
And so there we are, you know, we're
trying to be cool.
We're both thinking, boy, I sure hope I brought spare underwear.
Yes. No one mentioned this ahead of time.
No.
By the way, there'll be
they
a guy.
Said, he walked away.
They said, we have a little surprise for you tonight. You know,
11-foot surprise.
So that was our, we have pictures of us, and you want to see two very guys.
Terrified guys.
Trying hard to, you know, keep reading, but those things are heavy.
Well, now, they wouldn't have done this if he were lethal in any way.
I'm telling you, Paul, this was not a high, you know, this is not like, you know, the professional looking guy. You know, you want, if you have a guy with a snake, you want him to be wearing some kind of uniform and be carrying some kind of snake wrangler license from
Epaulettes.
The state.
Yeah.
Maybe with a couple of assistants
and a
cattle prod, something, you know? This guy just puts a snake on us and kind of wanders off. He's, boy, that thing was heavy. I've been holding that thing for the last hour.
And he says, it'll be okay.
And we're like,
and Dave says, does the snake know that?
So there's no tranquilizer gun in case
no.
things...
No. No. In fact, the other thing was we had some publicists from Disney who had flown down to Miami to be there for this event.
Why, we don't know.
Yeah. And, you know, we don't really usually need publicists. We usually handle it.
You do your own.
Right. We're wondering.
Yeah.
So the publicists were thinking, okay, here's one situation where it would be nice if the publicists were around because we got a snake on our shoulders and we don't know. And we look up and they're like, back, far
gone.
Back in the room, pressed up against the wall.
So how long were you weighed down by this snake?
It felt like about a year and a half. But it was
probably a good 5 or 6 minutes.
Yeah. Just a few minutes. But in that few minutes, I was so glad when the guy got the snake off. Oh.
But if I know both of you, when the guy did take it off, you thanked him. Right?
I'm sure we did.
But I don't remember thanking the snake man. I really don't.
Thank you, Mr.
He
Snake Wrangler.
He came around my neck, and the snake actually put its mouth right by my ear, and its head is the size of maybe two human fists.
Wow.
And it's going,
oh!
In my ear while I'm trying to read this thing. Oh.
Wow.
I was not very cool.
The road with Ridley and Dave.
Yeah. Reptile
fun. That's our low, probably our book tour low moment.
I love the fact that the Disney publicists, or maybe the bookstore, they probably went through the yellow pages. Well, you know what? We'll surprise them. We'll get a snake.
In Miami, I think if you just open your door and yell, hey, need a snake here, some guy's going to show up because there's a lot of snakes. We have a big snake problem in Miami, escaped Burmese pythons.
It's a big snake problem, and it's also a big snake problem.
Problem.
Both ways.
This is a true statistic. The estimate is right now that there are 100,000 Burmese pythons in the Everglades. They are
reproducing.
They escaped, or people just let them go because they get the.
Well, most of them are from New York, and they move there for the winter.
Exactly, they're from Jersey, and they can't drive. I mean, to save their lives, but they all have licenses.
They're
anyway.
In the left lane with their tails
with
blinking,
with a flicker on. But no, the estimate is that there are 100,000. The Burmese snake population in the Everglades is now estimated around 100,000. They're reproducing like crazy.
Huge.
They get to be 15 feet, 20 feet long. Yeah. So I figured out that if there are 100,000 of them and the average one is 15 feet long, mm-hmm. that is 284 miles of Burmese python right now mm-hmm. in the Everglades. So come on down!
Yeah. We could feed a few cities with that.
Those of you planning on vacationing in the Everglades this winter, there's, you know, bring the kids along and count them up. Why
Seems
not?
They're big enough to eat alligators.
I never really got the appeal of the Everglades. I mean, I live there and I've been to the Everglades a number of times, but
yeah.
I don't know. It's just how much grass can you look at?
I had the pleasure of driving across your state
sure.
in what they call Alligator Alley.
Alligator Alley, sure.
From the Gulf all the way over to...
You went right through the Burmese python territory.
I had no interest in stopping, getting out of the car, or doing anything.
No.
No, there's some outposts along there that sell trinkets.
You can watch the Miccosukee Indian tribe wrestle alligators out there.
There you go.
Or you can go to the casino. You know, your right. choice. Your call.
I'm more likely to be in the casino.
You're going
to
lose more money there than the alligator wrestling. But
that's perfectly all right. The book is called Peter and the Sword of Mercy, Dave Barry and Ridley Pearson. They'll be at the St. Louis County Library tonight at 7, and they're here today on the Big 550 KTRS with more right after this. This is the Big 550 KTRS. I'm Paul Harris, filling in for John Brown. That, of course, Bruce Springsteen. Here with me, two guys who've actually played with Bruce Springsteen, Dave Barry and Ridley Pearson.
But we didn't play music.
Yeah, we did. We played
Gloria.
Yeah,
you did. Dave told me the story a couple of years ago about
Bruce. Bruce sang, and I call him Bruce. He sang back up to me. I sang lead. Bruce sang harmony.
He had to ask Bruce if he knew how to play Gloria. It was a little embarrassing.
Bruce played my guitar.
But as you explained to me, if you take any guitar
and throw it on the ground, it will play Gloria all by itself.
The great GarageBand classic. Dave and Ridley are here promoting their new book called Peter and the Sword of Mercy. This is the fourth in their series, although not the fourth book that you've written together. You've written how many together at this point?
A big one's five. We wrote a book called Science Fair that came out last year.
And right. we wrote a series of smaller books called Neverland Books. So we've written eight or nine books together.
Yeah, something like that.
This in addition to your humor books, Dave, and Ridley, your crime books.
Right.
You talked to me a couple months ago about your latest one of those called Killer Summer. And let's talk about this book here. For people who don't know, these books, the Peter books, are prequels to Peter Pan.
Right. It tells the story of, well, it's become this whole world now, but it began when Ridley...
Yeah, it began with my daughter asking how Peter met Captain Hook in the first place and looking at that classic and realizing there's a boy who can fly who never grows old, Tinkerbell, shadows, all these things that aren't explained. We thought we would write a very small book that took a normal boy and he becomes Peter Pan. But mm-hmm. 550 pages later, we had reached the creation of Tinkerbell and realized there was an awful lot left to tell.
So that was the first one was called Peter and the Starcatchers. Then we wrote one called Peter and the Shadow Thieves. We sort of thought we were done there. Then we wrote a book called Peter and the Secret of Rundune, which is the one with the snake.
Really tied it all together for us.
And then we kind of we eased off and we wrote the science fair and we really weren't sure we were going to do another one of these, but I got and this is going to sound I hope this doesn't sound arrogant. We got this incredible response from
we got
kids,
bombarded by emails by kids
saying write another book. Mm-hmm. Really pretty much not so much, you know, requesting it, but just expecting it. You know? Well, where's the next book, you know? So,
yeah.
And we didn't, at first, we didn't think we were going to do that. But then we thought, we came up with what we thought was kind of a cool plot way to write another book that wasn't going to be just sort of, you know, repeating a plot.
And Dave stumbled into some very cool research, and those two forces.
I know you're thinking Dave and research doesn't, you know, what? What?
Well, there's a first for everything.
But it turns out there are these things called facts. And I've been unaware of this in my journalism career.
Yeah.
But we did a little research into the, believe it or not, the crown jewels. And
we're talking England here.
Yeah.
Discovered that there is, in fact, there's one of the crown jewels is a sword that is brought out during coronations called the Sword of Mercy, and it's kind of an interesting sword. It's missing the tip, and its origins are shrouded
there's
in mystery.
There's great myth around it.
And the mercy essentially is we're not going to use it to cut your head off, as they used to.
Well, yeah, sort of. I mean, what happened was the sword a guy tried to use it to kill somebody, and the tip broke, and they called it, you know, that's the legend. Actually, really nobody knows what happened.
Yeah, but the legend is it spared a life by breaking the tip, so it was the Sword of Mercy.
We may have spared that life, but the guy who made the sword killed.
Yeah, yeah. He's running a hedge fund. we thought, wouldn't it be cool if we could come up with a plot that involved that sword and the missing tip and involved the Peter Pan character, but moved it ahead by 23 years from the end of the last book. So the little girl who was the hero in the last
book. Has grown up
and has a daughter who now becomes the heroine, Wendy.
Which just takes me to exactly what I wanted to ask you. When you wrote the first book, we had a discussion about it on the radio. And I asked you, you know, how far away from the actual Peter Pan story do you have to stay? Well, now you've taken it 23 years forward. Molly is a mom. She has three children named Wendy, Michael, and John.
Hey.
Who anybody who knows about Peter Pan knows will be the three kids who will eventually fly away with Mary Martin.
Yeah.
Right.
So, or Kathy Rigby or whoever
That's
it is.
That's who it was, Kathy Rigby.
Yeah. And so now it's kind of like that old math problem. If you take one and you cut it in half, and then you cut that in half, and you cut that in half, eventually you get close to zero, but you never get
there. You never get to zero.
So how close can you get to the original Barry story without actually crossing over into that plot?
Well, I mean, where you can get to is the tapping on the window. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Bada bing.
Yeah.
How close are you to tapping on the window now in book four?
We have a window tap.
We do have a window tap.
Yeah, we have tappage. Yeah.
we've reached tapping.
That
didn't stop us.
That is not, though, necessarily the end of everything. If you, I mean, I don't, we've been driving around together and
too long
for the last couple of weeks, and we thought of another idea that would involve the same kind of universe that we've created here.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Dave pointed out that in all the GPS mapping of the Earth, we still have not found Neverland.
True.
Why is that?
Why does nobody know where Neverland is?
That got us really thinking.
Yeah.
It's next to the island on Lost, isn't it?
Hey, where is that?
Yeah.
It's right next to Neverland. You go to Neverland, you make a right. Like, so it's like East Neverland.
Go to the star and turn right.
It's a suburb of Neverland. Seriously, I tried to follow Lost and it got so my head hurt.
Yeah.
Know? If you missed one episode, you know. So did you follow that? Do you know
I've watched every episode, and my wife and I.
Is it off the air? Or is it still on the air?
No, it's coming back next year.
Okay,
and so you know what's going on?
No, I didn't say that. I said I watched every episode, and my wife and I have an ongoing bet: how many answers will there be in tonight's episode to questions that we have from the last four years, and will that be outnumbered by the number of new questions we don't understand?
Yeah. Right.
And it's always more questions than answers.
But you sort of can follow. I mean, I guess got so confused.
No, I can't follow it at all. At the end of every episode, I turn to my wife and I go, do you have any idea what's going on? No, but this is really fun. This is really fun.
No, I'm not denying the appeal of it. I just can't follow
it. Dave does an online real-time blogging for 24.
But that's
so
much that simpler.
As the scenes are going by, he's making comments on them. If you want to read something funny, you go on to Dave's 24 blog. You say that's simple? I can never figure out that shit.
Well, just you have to always remember that, you know.
If they die, they come to
life.
Every
few minutes, Jack's going to have to shoot somebody in the thigh to get them to talk. You know?
Here's what I find so fascinating about this. The humor writer can follow it. The mystery writer
who
comes up with these incredibly complex concepts and characters and all that sort of stuff has no idea what Jack Bauer is.
Because I'm actually trying to make sense of it, and Dave's just trying to laugh at it.
Last season, in my opinion, they reached sort of the all-time high or low, depending on how you look at point, when frogmen, enemy frogmen, got into the White House by swimming under the White House from the Potomac
nice.
River.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of us had to just go running to the map to find out.
I lived in Washington for 13 years. There's no waterway there.
Under the White House.
Yeah.
You would think that at some point the Secret Service would have noticed that. Hey, did you know that there's a waterway under the goes directly to the Potomac?
Jim, go check the grate. Make sure it's locked. That's all Jim has to do
every
day.
Is the sump pump working, honey?
If only Bill Clinton had known. You know?
So when it comes to plotting like that and trying to follow stuff, normally I would think that Ridley was in charge of the extreme technical part of plotting out the twists and turns of the plot, and then you were filling in character and that sort of thing. But now
no,
I'm
Dave's
kind of
a phenomenal
my mind.
Plotter.
No,
we sit down and we both plot it.
We have lots of plotting, yeah. Plotting going on.
And when I get too far gone, there's now a code that's the words are time traveling hamster. And if I'm saying, well, then they could do this, Dave will just stop me and say, Ridley, that's time traveling hamster.
Well, sometimes
that
Ridley
means, shut up, Ridley.
Ridley is very good at thinking of plot twists and turns, but sometimes he has so many twists and turns. Like, you know, we have a scene where a character has to get up and open a door, you know, and really we'll have some way that involves a winch, gunpowder, you know,
some Rube
a trampoline,
switching
and
shoes.
Three camels, you know, to open the door. Why can't he just, like, you know, open
the
door?
Because it's a book, Dave.
But what does the door look like?
Exactly.
So in Peter and the Sword of Mercy, you advance the story 23 years. Now you have new children who will grow up with the Peter Pan legend, with a mother who was already part of the Peter Pan legend.
And, you know, the thing is, she, Molly, who's been around the first three books, she was Peter's ally. She was 12, and he was 12. And, mm-hmm. You know, they fought the bad guys together.
Yep.
But she, which they defeated the bad guys, they thought, at the end of the third book. And when they go back to London, she gets married, raises her kids, and doesn't tell her kids about any of this stuff. She figures it's all
How
over. There's no
you?
Reason to yeah. burden her daughter, Wendy, with this knowledge that she's a star catcher and that there are these evil people, that mm-hmm. there's this stuff called star stuff. She doesn't tell her any of that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fine for 23. Well, the girl gets to be 12, and then suddenly it turns out it's not fine at all. And Molly tells her daughter, Wendy, hey, this is what's going on. Wendy doesn't believe it at first.
This is who you really are.
And then Molly disappears, and then it falls on Wendy then. She has to go find Peter, she has to find the island. And we had to,
in some really fun ways.
Yeah, we came up with a really kind of, we thought, pretty cool way to
again, get, involving research.
Yeah.
Some cool stuff.
Right? About early flying machines and how they worked and didn't work. So it was really neat. It was fun. We did a lot of research, actually.
Just last night, I was reading a chapter in which Wendy is flying an ornithopter.
That's it. And that's a real device.
Yeah.
What is an ornithopter?
Well, the way that at first, when they were trying powered flight early on, before they thought of using propellers.
Fixed wings.
They thought that the logical way to make a flying machine would be to have its wings flap.
Move the
because
wings.
That's how birds seem to do
I've
it.
I've seen the old black and white video of
right.
this.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, there turned out to be many problems with that, but those things that were meant to replicate the motion of birds were called ornithopters. And rich, you know, scientists, dabbling guys, spent huge amounts of money building these things. Never got any of them to work. As you know, you've seen the old films.
Yeah.
But we thought, what if a guy, you know, what if Wendy's uncle was just this crazy guy and he was one of these ornithopters?
And his
dudes.
Did work.
And, well, we had a special way of making it
right.
work. But, yeah, that was a lot of fun.
Not only make it work, but make it so that
A little girl
could fly it.
It could fly
See,
it.
That was
with the
help
of porpoises.
Well, you know, there were two problems with the stuff that fell apart in the old black and white videos. One, it was all in black and white. That never works. Yeah, gotta
Nothing
have it
flies
color.
In black and white.
Right. And two, it was far too difficult. You've got to make it so simple.
Well, and there was a 180-pound man trying to
exactly
commandeer it.
Get a 65-year-old girl in there, and those things would have flown.
Yeah.
We never would have heard of Orville and Wilbur.
This was actually the origin of Southwest Airlines.
The book is called Peter and the Sword of Mercy, Dave Barry and Ridley Pearson. They'll be at the St. Louis County Library headquarters branch in Frontenac on Lindbergh Boulevard, and I'll be emceeing that book signing.
Yeah,
tonight.
You didn't tell
Thank
them that.
You for
You're
doing that.
Be there.
Well, it's my pleasure. It's always my pleasure to be there.
Well,
with
you open up with about an hour and a half of comedy with
yeah,
some juggling.
Like yes.
Yeah. Good.
Okay. It's the mime work that the kids love so
bring,
much.
Bring a snake tonight, would you?
No, I
Thank
won't
you.
Be doing that.
Thank you
no?
very much.
But get there early if you're coming and bringing the kids. Get there 6:30 if you want to get a good seat. It's always a great time with these guys, and we'll have more in a moment here on the Big 550 KTRS.
Charlemagne, conqueror of Europe, knelt before the stone altar. He was 70, but with his reddish beard and full head of hair, he looked much younger. His lanky frame still held much of the strength that had made him a feared warrior. Although usually surrounded by his knights, he chose to pray alone. He prayed for the peace to continue. And as always, he prayed for forgiveness for his son, now 40, but still a boy in his father's eyes.
That is Jim Dale reading from Peter and the Sword of Mercy, the new book by Dave Barry and Ridley Pearson. You both seemed surprised when you heard Jim's voice there.
Yeah, he is a phenomenal guy, Jim Dale.
We like him a lot.
But he read the Harry Potter books in America, which is a big deal for him, getting him in the audiobook market. And then he's read our books, and we're thrilled about that. But the guy has got a fantastic resume. He's done everything on stage you can do.
Won every award for it.
Did you know he wrote Georgie Girl?
I did not know that.
Yes.
I saw him on stage in the 70s. I was in New York and went to see a show called Scapino that he starred in. And it didn't really matter who else was in the show. It was essentially him all over the stage.
He has a way. When we were in New York for the beginning of this book tour, he came to a couple of our events. And Ridley and I always read a chapter or two from our books. And we heard Jim Dale do it live, you know?
Yeah.
And we were embarrassed to even. Because he's got that unbelievable. He could read the phone book, as they say, and you would listen to it.
Now, when you're writing the book, and when he does the audiobook, by the way, he doesn't just do it as the narrator, he's doing voices.
Oh my gosh, he does 50, 60 voices. Yeah.
So when you're writing the book, do you hear his voice in your head for each of these characters, or
I do now. I don't know about Rid, but
yeah, I don't.
When we wrote the first book, obviously he hadn't recorded it yet, and we didn't know he ever would.
Right.
But we called him, and he wanted to talk to us, and we had this conference call where he starts going about
proposing voices to us.
You know, he said, "Now, Mrs. Bumrake, I see she's from Yorkshire, but she would like to sound more like she's." Her voice would be like this, but then she would put on a little air and sound like
each
this.
Each time he's altering it.
And after like a minute of that, we go, "So, Jim, what is it you want to know from us?" Because we didn't know any of that about this character.
He's creating backstory for the character.
And changing their accent with the backstory.
You know?
Yeah. Wow.
Exactly.
He's got a gift.
It's just a total gift.
And then when you watch him read it. He's just reading to an audience, but his whole body, his hands start moving, he does this one scene where it's a very funny scene, Captain Hook and Mr. Smee, when Captain Hook sees the ship he's been given by the natives, and it has pink sails, which is appalling to Captain Hook. And he becomes Hook, and then he becomes Smee. And when he becomes Smee, his body gets tinier.
Just shrinks.
He shrinks. Then when he's Hook, he gets bigger again. It's hilarious to watch him. Yeah. And that he does that when he's reading it. You don't see that when you listen to the thing, but
he is there.
Phenomenal work. So that's the audiobook version.
And he's actually a woman. That's the most amazing. He can play Jim Dale. No,
and dead 8 years. Yeah. And still,
and still
that's how
man.
Good he yeah, is.
Remarkable.
Yeah. You're talking about the ships. I've got to ask you about the pirate ships, which, of course, are always part of the book. Are either of you seafarers who've had experience on ships, anything like these?
Not big ships. I actually do sail some. My college roommate is a big sailor, and so over the years, for many years now, I've gone on sailing trips with him. So I could vaguely familiar with what it's like to be on a sailboat.
And but, I sailed a ton as a kid. I haven't in many years.
But nothing on a big three-masted?
No. But fortunately, one of the proofreaders at Disney is a sailor. And she's
always correcting us.
Corrected us quite a bit. But our first book, one of the people who corrected us was Roy Disney, the son of one of the Disney brothers.
Uh-huh.
And we made the mistake of putting the nice part of the ship where the swells would stay in the front of the ship.
And he said no,
it'd be in the back of the ship. And that's our correction from Mr. Disney. Okay, Mr. Disney.
We'll do it your way.
Yeah, when it comes to big ships and nice parts, a Disney would be a good person.
Well,
to
he happens
that.
To be a world-class competitive racing sailor.
Yeah.
He has some
big, big time.
Yeah, so we took his advice, not just because his name is Disney.
Tonight, you'll be doing a book signing at the St. Louis County Public Library in Frontenac, and you've done these all over the place for each of these books, and you've done so many of them. I'm curious, what do the kids say to you when they come up after your presentation and they want to talk to you about the books.
Well, the fun thing about kids is they don't care about the rights and they don't care about movies or anything. They care about story and character.
Right.
Of course, half the time they come up and say, "So is the next book ready?" You know, like like we did it this morning or something.
Yeah.
Or they'll ask some question that we cannot possibly answer. So because they believe in their own way they sort of believe that world is
they
real.
They enter that world.
Sure. And so which is what you want.
Exactly.
So they'll ask a question. It really doesn't matter in terms of the story, but they just want to know, like, when they got on the island, what did they eat? You know, and we don't really discuss that, in a book. You don't describe everybody's.
They need to ask Jim Dale. He's already figured that out.
Jim Dale knows not only what they eat, but how they chewed, but
and what it sounded like.
But then we have to decide, are we going to make up an answer right now, or are we going to say we really don't know, what they ate? We didn't really think about that. But to them, that's something you should know because you were the one, you're their portal to that world.
One of the kids asked, "How old is the porpoise?" Right to Dave, right? Live.
And I said,
we were both dumbfounded.
I said, 12. He's 12.
And the kid accepted it, just like that. But Dave at least could act quickly because I just went brain dead, how old is the porpoise?
Ridley can speak porpoise, however.
Yeah.
Ridley, say something in porpoise.
I'll say, "Hi, Paul."
Very nice.
Thank you.
See?
Yeah. And out my there, diction's a little off.
All the porpoise listeners of the Big 550 are going, finally, some content for us.
Yeah, the Mississippi River porpoises love this
That's
show.
It.
We are number one.
Among porpoises.
In
the porpoise demographic.
Yes, when it comes to mammals with fins, number one.
That's our biggest
demographic. Your kids, your daughter is the one who started this by asking the Dr. Hook question. Are your two
Dr.
daughters?
Dr. Hook.
Captain
Dr.
Hook. You're going back to the 60s there.
She came up to you and said, "Was he really a medicine man?"
Dr. Hook.
Captain Hook. I'm sorry.
That's all right.
I apologize. That's the radio side for too long. But I'm curious if having.
She was only 16. Wasn't that his hit? One of his hits.
Cover of the Rolling Stone, I think, was
that.
That
was also another one.
Yeah.
Yes, go ahead.
I'm curious if your children have grown up to be storytellers.
Yeah, I mean, I think they both appreciate it. They're both big readers now, which is fun to see. And they aren't writing on their own as much as Dave's daughter. Sophie writes all the time. But they appreciate a good story and are pretty good at telling stories. But Sophie's really a little writer.
Yeah, she writes stories and plays all the time. And she has an agent. Not yet.
How long have you been sitting down behind a typewriter or, in these days, a keyboard and writing professionally? How old were you when you got your first paycheck?
I started really in college as an intern for a magazine in Washington, D.C. And when I got out of college, I went to work for a newspaper. So it's since I hate to say, but almost 40 years.
You could say it.
40 years.
I've been doing this for, since high school.
But I know, but I'm only 32. So it's like, but I know, 40 years I've been basically writing.
40 porpoise years.
Writing for a living.
That's how we do that. Yeah. And at one point, your humor column was syndicated in 500 newspapers. You did that for, I think it was 22 years?
Yes, yeah.
Before you called it quits in 2005. How do you make the jump from a guy who's writing a column in Philadelphia, which you were at the time for the Philadelphia Daily News, to other newspapers saying, "Hey, we want to run that"? And syndicating it and becoming Dave Barry, D, capital B.
It was first of all, it was actually the Westchester, Pennsylvania Daily local news. Not as nearly as big as the Philadelphia Daily.
Oh.
Although in the end, the Daily News did run my column. It was kind of weird. I was writing these little columns for the Daily local news, and I would Xerox them and mail them to Sunday magazine editors. Back then, most newspapers had Sunday magazines. Today, very few do.
They have Parade.
Parade is kind of, yeah, this was when it was a local, it was the magazine of that paper.
Right.
Parade is nationally published.
Yeah.
And eventually they started running them. It was kind of a, and then they tended to be sheep-like somewhat in that with one paper. Once a big paper started to run my column, then other big papers thought, it must be okay to run this column. So that's really how I got
it. So did a syndicator come to you? Is that how?
No, I sent it off to, I got rejected by all the syndicates at first, yeah.
Speaking of being rejected and getting negative feedback like that.
Yeah.
I know in the radio industry, if the front desk gets two calls about something that happened on the air,
you're gone.
No, I won't be gone. No, that's a different sort of, that's usually management calling. But if there are two people who complain about something, there's a meeting. Well, and I'm curious about what that's like when you're a humor columnist. Did you ever have somebody in any of those 500 markets that you were in who complained so much that somebody, we're going to have to not run your column anymore?
Well, that would come up, yeah. I mean, it depends on what column I'd written. But what I learned from the newspaper business, and I think it's true of any mass medium, is that people who like what you're doing generally don't do anything about it. They just keep listening.
Absolutely.
They like your show. Eh, if you tell a joke, they like it, they laugh. But they don't call you and say, I liked it, I laughed.
Yeah, what was the last time you called a TV station
exactly.
and said...
But if you're mad, if you're angry, you'll call.
Yep.
Those people. So, you know, I could write a column that I assume most people liked, you know, but one or two people didn't. Those are the people who write in. And I think that phenomenon occurs at newspapers all the time. The phone rings, an editor answers. He's got an angry person on the line. His instinct is to stop whatever it was that caused that from happening. Without really considering that it may have been something that was actually positive for most people
right.
listening. So I don't know what you do about that.
But his motivation is not, oh, you're doing something wrong. It's, you're making my phone ring.
Exactly. I don't want this hassle anymore.
Yeah.
So, that is a problem, I think, especially if you're doing something that's, well, if you're in the humor business.
One of the best bosses I ever had some 25 years ago, I was doing a morning show in Hartford, Connecticut at the time. And he came in. I was on the air until 10 o'clock in the morning, but he got in at 9. And at 9 o'clock, he pokes his head in the door and says, I need to see you when you get off the air, which is an ominous thing to say to anybody. You know, we're trying to be funny and have a goofy time on it. He comes in with a serious face. So at 10 o'clock, I go down the hall to his office, and I say, Dan, what's up? He says, have a seat. Oh, no. Oh, no, not this meeting. And I say, no, okay, I sit down. What's the problem? He says, I haven't gotten a complaint call about your show in about a month. Do something about that. And I thought, wow,
that's
this
good.
Guy really gets it.
Yeah, that is good. Yeah. Radio, that's got to be good.
It's very good.
But I always said, if you write a humor column, it will offend somebody. Mm-hmm. I've never written a column that didn't offend somebody. Mm-hmm. If I write about lawyers, then lawyers complain and doctors love it. If I write about doctors, lawyers complain.
Yeah.
I mean, you know how it is.
Yeah.
But if you write about Peter Pan.
Write about Peter Pan, everybody loves it.
Is there such a thing as a complaint about... Well, I guess the only complaint here is that you don't tell them what they eat, right?
You can get J.M. Barrie purists.
Yeah, but the kids who actually read the books, we'll get is helpful constructive criticisms.
Right.
You know, like, I think when you had this scene, it would have made more sense if they had done this. Mm-hmm. I get letters like that mm-hmm. routinely, and sometimes their ideas are terrific.
Yeah, they're good ideas.
We just didn't think of what it is they thought of.
And does that then become fodder for... Book five?
It makes us very aware now. I'm much more aware now than in the first book of every single plot move we have them make. The kids are going to scrutinize.
Yeah, they're going to be
scrutinized. They're going to wonder, why did you do that? Not just kids, actually, grown-ups as well. What, you know, why did you do that and not this? You know.
Now, here's the thing I'd be worried about if I were in your shoes. You go to a book signing, you're talking to some kids, you're having an innocuous conversation, they say, why don't you do this and this and this? And you look at each other and go, that's a good idea. And in the next book, you actually do that?
And then they sue.
And then you get sued. Hey, you stole my kid's idea.
Yeah. Well.
Roy Disney, get him on the phone. Not another call about a ship, is it?
That's why we have those kids rounded up after the show.
They're in a holding pen in central Illinois.
Well, bring your kids and their ideas and their love of these books to the St. Louis County Library Headquarters branch in Frontenac on Lindbergh tonight at 7. Get there early, 6:30 or so you can get them a good seat. And you'll see Dave Barrie and Ridley Pearson reading from the book, talking about the book.
No snakes.
No snakes. Taking questions from the audience. And
we got some slides.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
we,
you do?
We do a little slide show.
We do a little slide show.
Audio and visual.
That's it.
Very
That's
impressive.
It. Yeah.
I will be your humble MC tonight, and I hope you'll come down and say hi to the guys tonight, 7 o'clock at the St. Louis County Library. The book is called Peter and the Sword of Mercy, and it is always a pleasure having you in, guys.
Thanks for having us on, man.
Thank you very much. I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS.